Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
The focus of the Book in Common this year is the Year of the Woman. The idea behind the Book in Common is to give the community a common platform for discussion, raising issues, and bringing together the community in a common read. It's like a really big book club. This year's Book in Common is My Life on the Road by feminist icon Gloria Steinem. Ms. Steinem will be in Chico next Wednesday, March 1st, in Lackson Auditorium. All Lackson general admission tickets are sold out, but Chico performances will be airing a live simulcast in Harlan Adams Theater. One of the events inspired by Gloria Steinem's book takes place today in the Bell Memorial Union on the Chico State campus. Women of Wisdom is an evening of storytelling by Native American women from several area tribes. Joining me as co-host today is North State Public Radio's General Manager Beth Lamberson and our guest Gloria Steinem by telephone.
Gloria, what an honor to speak with you today. Thanks for taking the time with us. What I love in your book is you write, "How do I love campuses? Let me count the ways." And I'd like to get your perspective on what gives you hope on college campuses today and what gives you concern.
Well, clearly what gives me concern is the degree of debt that students find themselves in when they graduate. This was not true in my generation. We were not indentured when we graduated. And it's not true in any other country that I know of. It's clearly outrageous. And it's in large part due to state legislatures who have used their money to build prisons we don't need instead of to subsidize public universities we do need. So I'm very concerned about that. What gives me hope are the students themselves and the fact that the courses are now way more inclusive than they were in my lifetime. Not inclusive enough, mind you. I mean, I think still history is somewhat political in what it records and what it doesn't, but it's greatly improved.
So when you visit campuses, you find that the students express that concern about the overwhelming debt that they face?
Yes, absolutely. You know, I always ask people to put up their hands how many people are graduating in debt, and it's been increasingly more over the years, and a huge amount of debt, and debt that can't be bankrupted. You know, this is a new and outrageous development.
Gloria, I reached out to some friends and family knowing I'd be speaking with you, and the overwhelming consensus was, what are you saying to today's young women, especially in light of the recent election, that we didn't even need to say to people 5 and 6 years ago?
First of all, I'm listening half the time. You know, I think it's super important that we both listen as much as we talk and talk as much as we listen, depending on which side of the authority system we are, because if we don't do that kind of democracy going in, we don't have democracy coming out. So I learn at least as much as I have to say. Having a longer view does make you see that things were once as bad or worse. For instance, as I was saying at the march, it took 4 murders to get Richard Nixon elected into office. There was Jack Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and Malcolm X. At least now the Obamas are alive, the Clintons are alive, but it's clear that we have had a very dangerous coup, and this is unique in my lifetime because he actually lost by a bigger margin, 10 million votes if you count people who voted either for Hillary Clinton or the other candidates, by a huge margin, but because of the Electoral College, which was a device put into the Constitution by the slave states, he won, and it's becoming more and more clear that it's as much a coup as an election because he doesn't understand that there are 3 balanced parts of government. And I think most seriously, the 3 women from the American Psychiatric Association who wrote a letter that you can find online just saying, you know, this is a very clear example of a narcissistic personality disorder person who cannot resist responding to the smallest slight, however irrational it may be. You know, even that Schwarzenegger say he has to, show that he's defeated Schwarzenegger in ratings, even though it's against his own financial interest, since he's one of the producers of that program. And at a much bigger level, that he has to say he's very impressed by the flattery of Putin, even though Russia is an enemy. So I wonder if the people around him are not more responsible than he is, because they're more likely to know fact from fiction.
Here at North State Public Radio, Gloria, we broadcast to 12 northern counties in Central California. A lot of red voters here in our area, in a blue state. Why do you think women voted for the 45th president?
You know, I think that, as you note, it was 53% of white married women, not of white unmarried women, and certainly not of women of color. So I always remember that it was the Chinese habit to footbind the women in powerful families, not poor women. And I think it's way more likely that those of us who are dependent on men's income, and pretty clear that we would not have the same ability to raise our kids or, you know, have a position in society if it weren't for our dependency, then are way more likely to vote an interest other than our own. But if we're in the paid labor force, we're supporting ourselves, as of course women of color are way more likely to do, and men of color are not, in the positions of inherited wealth and influence and so on. So, you know, I think it, when you think about it, it makes sense. But I don't mean to say that I know why each woman voted. I don't. You know, we have to listen to each other. I mean, some women voted because of their religious beliefs, for instance. So even though he's a very irreligious man, just on the issue, say, of reproductive rights, they may have voted. I've met people, actually men, but in this case, but people who voted for Bernie Sanders and voted for Trump, because in both cases it was a protest vote just for someone that they saw is not the Washington establishment.
My guest is Gloria Steinem, and her book, My Life on the Road, is this year's Book in Common. Gloria, I was intrigued by something you said in your introduction, that from Joseph Campbell and his hero's journey to Eugene O'Neill, heroes were kept from the sea by clinging women. And you say, I would never become an obstacle to any man's freedom. You said you vowed silently that you would never become an obstacle to any man's freedom. And why did you conclude that?
Well, I was being offered only that role because that was what was written. And it was so clearly a resented role and a limiting role that I wasn't smart enough to say I'm going to take my own journey, but I was at least smart enough to say I'm not going to be that kind of restriction.
Well, then you follow that paragraph with, even the dictionary defines adventurer as a person who has, enjoys, or seeks adventures, but adventuress is a woman who uses unscrupulous means in order to gain wealth or social positions.
Uh-oh.
Yes, the dictionary can tell us a lot about sexism and racism. Yes.
I found that rather shocking today. So how can you do anything about that?
You know, the Women's Media Center has a mammoth book of gender-free, racist-free language that I commend to you, because we are trying to make it possible and easy to have a bigger choice of words. So I think it is possible, but we have to think about it.
Gloria, I have, enlightened friends. We all listen to public radio, family members. But I was asked specifically to ask you, how do we have a conversation with men who truly believe that they don't have a bias, but we're very aware that they are? I mean, when someone's super blatant, it's easier to call them out. But when it's more of a nuanced part of someone, how would you have a conversation with that person? Or what would be the questions you would ask, or what would you look for?
No, I think we have to consider what would work on us. You know, if we were, as we probably are, behaving with bias without knowing it, what would be helpful? And usually that means not hostility. It means an appeal to empathy. So perhaps if we can think of situations, for instance, if we're talking to someone who has experienced religious bias or class bias, if we try to expand that, you know, to understand bias by sex as well, or if we ask that person to think what life might have been like if they were exactly the same person with the same humor and smarts and ambition and had been born female. Think seriously, what would your life have been like? Then I think empathy can help. And in any case, it's important just to say, look, I know you didn't mean this, but this is how, you know, I feel because of what you said, and here's why.
Thank you for that, Gloria. I was especially interested in what you say about your time in India. And 20 years passed between your first visit to India and your second visit. And you write that after your second visit, you saw your own past differently. And how was that?
When I was there the first time, and I lived there for 2 years, I came home and I kind of assumed that everything that I had been so transformed by in India was not applicable at home. That was partly because it was so early that people in this country were not interested in India. It was just after independence, and if I started conversations talking about India, people's eyes glazed over, you know. And it was partly my own lack of understanding that what I had learned was universal, not just particular to India. So it wasn't until almost 20 years after I had been there the first time when I went back again and I saw in both countries the burgeoning women's movement, which was coming out of small groups meeting together, saying, you know, individual women saying what happened to them, discovering it also happened to other women, that these small groups were actually the same as the small Gandhian groups and villages that I had seen 20 years before. But I wasn't understanding that what I was seeing was universal, not particular to India.
And you call these talking circles. You might explain to people who aren't familiar with how a talking circle works, how that works.
You know, if you just think of it as the most universal human unit, you know, sitting around a campfire telling stories, which we've been doing for hundreds of thousands of years, I think you get the imagery. And it's also the most universal and earliest form of self-governance. It depends on each person speaking. So there's often, say, in Native American talking circles, a talking stick that is passed around. And while you have the stick, you have the ability to talk, and everyone must listen, and then you pass it on, and then you must listen. And it's the way communal decisions were made. And in fact, layers of these talking circles were part of the Iroquois Confederacy, or the Haudenosaunee, or the government system of six huge nations of North America. And it's what our Constitution was based on. Our Constitution was based on the talking circles of the Haudenosaunee or the Iroquois Confederacy, because Benjamin Franklin had at least some knowledge of them because he had been the ambassador to those governance systems, and he invited four Iroquois men to the to Philadelphia to advise on the structure of the Constitution, because we had a similar goal, which was to keep some self-governance with the 13 colonies and at the same time have a system of mutual governance. I must say that when the four Iroquois advisors arrived, the first thing they said was, "Where are the women?" They were appalled.
Yeah, that struck me when I read that in your book.
Yes, right. And, of course, also they were appalled that it was slavery. I mean, they didn't, you know. So it isn't as if we measured up to the degree of democracy in the Iroquois Confederacy. But it is true that it was the first model, because what the European immigrants had come from were monarchies and religious monarchies.
My guest is activist Gloria Steinem. I'm Nancy Wigman, and joining me as co-host today is North State Public Radio's general manager, Beth Lamberson.
Gloria, I learned so much reading your book. History, I think it should be more than just a book in common here in the North State. I learned about Ho Chi Minh. I learned about Look Magazine. My father worked at Look Magazine back in the
really?
Day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's just this book by Gloria Steinem, My Life on the Road, is just so rich with information and details about things that either we missed when they were happening, like the greatest event that never got talked about with your women's conference. But I was really impressed by the fact that you didn't stick just to feminism, but that you also went to the Native communities, to the farm workers, to people of color. And sometimes within the work that you did, there were feminists who didn't necessarily see the challenges of patriarchy as something that should be also then worked with in all these other groups. Was it a conscious decision for you to say,
no, it's just
I want to bridge
suddenly,
this?
I suddenly realized at the Houston Conference, because there were a large group of women from Indian country there, that they knew things I didn't know. And I gradually, over time, began to realize that much that we want was here in the first place. So it isn't like they're two separate things. It's like they're the same. I mean, first of all, in a very basic way, you know, what women have that nobody else has is wombs. So the source of our power and our subjugation is that, you know, if we can govern our own bodies, then we decide when and whether to give birth, and that's a huge amount of power. The control of our own bodies is taken away from us, so that we cannot decide when and whether to give birth. And that is a huge reason for loss of life and education and autonomy. And, you know, if you can't control your life from the skin in, you can't control it from the skin out. And the Native American women, as far as anybody knows, you know, clearly did have that kind of autonomy. They decided when and whether to give birth with herbs and abortifacients and timing. They quite well understood it, and men participated in birth. And it was a society that was about balance, or to put it another way, the paradigm was a circle, not a pyramid. So, you know, it was my learning, because I, you know, if you don't, you know, I, you know, so who was it who said that if you don't learn history, you're condemned to repeat it? I have to look up that quote, because I think the truth is that history is concealed from us because we might repeat it.
Your friendship with Wilma Mankiller was really lovely to read. I've had the opportunity to have met her in the past. She's the principal chief of the Cherokee Nation. What do you miss most about her?
Oh, so many things, so many things. First of all, because she had survived the literal annihilation of 90% of her people by a culture that was actually, by pretty much every measure, inferior in terms of science, agriculture, governmental structures, so on. And, you know, when I would say to her, how can you possibly, how can you bear this? She would always say, we're still here. And not only would she say, we're still here, she would say, and we're continuing this knowledge because we know that people will turn to us because they need it.
You mentioned that when you were in India, that birth control was very much a concern of the women there. And they ask you about that. Were you able to help?
Well, they actually, India is in advance of us in that regard. And even when I was there the first time, there was already a national program of birth control because to try to make it available in a more scientific way. I mean, it had been available traditionally and then stamped out by patriarchal religions. I mean, Hinduism became patriarchal, and then there were also a lot of Christian missionaries that were punishing contraception. So they were reintroducing modern forms of birth control even when I was there. But the instance you're talking about was going into a third-class railway car, which was reserved for women. And because they knew I came from America and they thought of America as more advanced, which, of course, is not always the case, but anyway, they were asking me about birth control.
Well, I thought it was interesting that you discussed Gandhi and Martin Luther King in the same chapter. I'm always been fascinated by the fact that Henry David Thoreau in the 19th century got this literature from India that he so admired and wanted to live like that. And his essay on civil disobedience was read by Gandhi, so it goes back to India. And then Martin Luther King is influenced by Gandhi's work in India. So there's this exchange back and forth from India on civil disobedience.
Yes, because it's peaceful power, mm-hmm. in a more Hindu translation. So it's a way of behaving with strength and nonviolence. Of course, in all of these cases, they were still reflecting the more recent patriarchal times, because these were men talking to men. They were still, none of them were still quite understanding that part and parcel of this way of thinking is that, you know, there is no gender, there is no race, people are people, and that women, you know, are at least an equal role. I mean, for instance, in this country, in native cultures, women tended to control agriculture and men hunted, but both were equal. And the oldest cultures in India are at the southern tip, Kerala, and a little above Kerala. And those still are the areas of the highest literacy rate, for instance, higher even than in Europe, I believe, because they were once matrilineal.
Well, you know, I think we are somewhat ignorant of our own history in regard to for example, racism. You, in your chapter on talking circles, you mention a Mrs. Green, mm-hmm. this older woman who had worked in Washington during the Truman administration in the same big room as white clerks, but she was segregated behind a screen.
Yes, yes.
And I find that hard to believe that recently in our own history,
but
I mean, I know it's true.
Have you seen the film Hidden Figures?
I was going to ask you that very question.
Yes, because
so
I
moving.
Think that's an excellent film, and it shows that in Virginia, which was the percentage-wise biggest slaveholding state in the Confederacy, even then in the I guess that was in the 50s, wasn't it? The space
yes.
program, or in the early 60s?
Early 60s, yeah.
Early
60s. Yeah.
There was still, everything was segregated, water fountains, bathrooms, and Virginia also disobeyed the school integration order so much so that the state legislature funded segregated schools. So, you know, Virginia was one of the, Loving, also the movie Loving, which is, you know, about the first
beautiful film.
Yeah, interracial marriage, so-called. That also took place in Virginia. So, you know, if people see that movie, they will understand how recently it was profoundly segregated.
And I was glad at the end of Hidden Figures they showed the real women who were a part of that story and made it so real for those of us watching the movie.
Yes, absolutely. And it, you know, their history is full of those kinds of examples. So we need to really look at the politics of history. I have a book, it's actually about India, but it could be about us, called The History of History. You know, well, because history tends to be written by the conquerors.
Oh, yeah.
And it turns out that in a generalized way, oral history is more accurate than written history because it comes from multitudinous sources and eyewitness accounts. So it tends to be somewhat more accurate than accounts written from above by the conquerors.
Well, now, you have a perspective that most don't because you have been an activist for so many years that you've seen a lot of marches beginning back in the 60s. And how do you characterize women's marches then and now?
Well, each one, you know, has a spirit of its own. So I'm not trying to just make them all into one. But I would say that the first march on Fifth Avenue, which I think was in 1971, wasn't it? That it was commemorating the vote for women. And it was the most like the Women's March on Washington in the sense of being contagious, because it just started out in the hundreds, and then as we marched on Fifth Avenue saying, join us, you know, given the nature of New York with all the people there, people were, you know, cleaning women were hanging out of the windows of office buildings, you know, cheering us on, and we were yelling, join us. And so, you know, we just multiplied by 100 by the time we got to where we were gathering. But, of course, nothing in this country has been as big as this last Women's March to Washington, or as contagious, you know, from small towns in Alaska and Arkansas and Oklahoma, you know, and there were even more people in Los Angeles. It was the biggest ever march in Washington, and there were even more people in Los Angeles.
Well, I was shocked in your address when you spoke. You said that that march required 1,000 more buses than the inauguration the day before. And
yes,
did I
right.
understand that correctly?
Yes.
Wow.
And it's evidence of the president's immaturity or narcissism that he objected to the photographs, the actual physical photographs of the inauguration, on the grounds that they must somehow be false because they were showing vast areas of unoccupied ground. And he called up somebody from the Park Service to reprimand them. I mean, this is really a serious problem we have here.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation with this year's Book in Common author, Gloria Steinem. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. I'm Nancy Wigman, joined today by station manager Beth Lamberson. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman, joined today by General Manager Beth Lamberson. You know, you were pictured in Time magazine recently as one of the co-chairs of the march, and you're standing there with Harry Belafonte. And when I looked at that photograph of you and the photograph on the cover of your book, I thought, my gosh, they're hardly, there's hardly a difference. Your hair's a little shorter now, maybe.
No,
you don't have the big glasses on.
There's a lot of difference, right?
But the fact that you are still so involved, you're still on the road? After all these years, you're still on the road.
Yes, well, it's just infinitely interesting. I mean, I do recognize, or I'm trying to make myself recognize, that I am not immortal. You know, I don't have that much time left, so I do want to stay home more to write more. But it's just infinitely interesting.
You still like being on the road, and you say in your book that you're not suggesting that the rest of us travel as much as you have, and I like the way you wrote that. Would you read that section in your introduction, Gloria?
Oh, yes. Okay. Like Skye Masterson. I wonder if people still remember him from Guys and Dolls, the wandering gambler in Damon Runyon's stories. I've been in more hotel rooms than the Gideon Bible, and he didn't wash his hair with hotel soap, eat from vending machines, or sit up late organizing with the hotel maids. After my first two decades traveling as an organizer, I realized that the longest stretch I'd spent at home was 8 days. As you can see, I'd fallen in love with the road.
Gloria, when you are out on the road, I really enjoyed the stories of, you know, you were outside Sturgis where they have the huge motorcycle rally, and wondering if you and your companions were, you know, fish out of water, and the people that continue to come up to you and say thank you, and that they're not fitting a stereotype. You're still pleasantly surprised by that.
Yes, because, you know, we had all seen movies about motorcycle mobs, and there may well be some, you know, but we were way more worried about it than it turned out we should have been, because, you know, that as I was having breakfast in the motel dining room, one of the women who was, you know, part of this motorcycle group, although it was mostly men, but she and her husband were both motorcyclists. And there she was with her leather jacket and her huge hairdo and so on. And she came over to me, and her husband is full of, you know, tattoos and chains and so on. And she came over and she said, "Isn't that Alice Walker you're traveling with?" She said, "I really like her poetry." And I just thought, okay, you know, we just have to give up the idea that we can, you know, we have to talk to each other to know to know who we are.
I would just say I like the color of her motorcycle.
Yes, purple.
A purple motorcycle.
Harley. She kept saying to me, "You should see my grandkids when grandma drives up on a purple Harley." And she was so proud of the fact that she had her own motorcycle, because for the first many years of her marriage, she was riding on the back of her husband's motorcycle. And it had Ms. on the license plate. And so, you know, she ended up teaching me, really, that inside all of us, we have a purple Harley just waiting to get on it and ride.
Well, perhaps, Gloria, that could be your first exploration into motoring your own vehicle. Maybe we need to get you on a motorcycle while you're in Chico.
You know, I'm not sure. I don't think I'm quite ready to
how
do
about
that.
A Vespa?
I do believe, you know, though I don't have a driver's license anymore, I do know how to drive. I think everybody should be able to know how to swim and drive. But I don't think I'm up for learning how to drive a motorcycle.
So if our listeners see Gloria Steinem on a Vespa, perhaps, while she's in Chico, just give her a big wave.
Gloria, you said that there are three reasons you wrote this book, and the third one was, "My third hope is to share stories."
Yes.
And I really like what you have to say about the stories.
Yes, I think if we just think about our own experience, what helps us understand and what captures our attention is a story. I mean, we've been sitting around campfires telling stories. So narrative and imagery is the way our brains work. If you tell me a statistic or give me a generality, I probably will invent a story as to why it's true. And it's very important that we remember that. And I think that often serious news has failed to realize that, because it is composed of statistics and generalities. Hard news, so-called, and soft news is less respected because it has narrative. So it leaves us vulnerable to celebrities who become the only stories in town.
And you said, you wrote in your book, I discovered the magic of people telling their own stories to groups of strangers. And you said one of the simplest paths to deep change is for the less powerful to speak as much as they listen, and for the more powerful to listen as much as they speak.
Yes.
Have you had any luck with that? That seems
yes.
like that would be pretty hard to change.
Well, if you just say it, it already changes consciousness. And I'm not suggesting that it's easy for people who have been accustomed to hiding by listening rather than talking to talk, nor that it's easy for the powerful to listen as much as they speak. It's not easy. But it's such a simple, logical measure that if you just say it, it has an impact.
In your afterword, Gloria, you wrote about how really until past the age of 50, you didn't really have a home. And I liked your comment about you'd one day be a bag lady, but you would organize all the other bag ladies. So,
yes, that was the way I dealt with this fearful fantasy that I was going to be a bag lady.
You would have been a powerful bag lady organizer, I have no doubt. However, you actually had a home and had to buy sheets and linens and, you know, candles and things like that, that you suddenly felt so much freer with your travel.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it made me realize that once again, you know, the world is wrongly divided into two kinds of people, those who divide everything into two and those who don't, you know. So we keep thinking that either you're on the road or you have a home, but actually we all need both. I mean, even birds have nests. You know, they have, you know, flights of migration of thousands of miles, but they also very carefully build nests. So it made me realize that I had been on the road without feathering my nest, so to speak, and so it really made a difference when I created a home I was happy to come back to.
We touched on earlier just a little bit about the National Women's Conference in Houston as the big event that so few people know about. How do you put that into words, exactly what the goals were there, what went down, and even the fact mm-hmm. of why we're not talking about it?
This was the product of hard work by Bella Abzug and Shirley Chisholm and Patsy Mink and other women in Congress who actually got it funded, not by much money, but some money. It was a two-year-long process with women elected in each state and territory in a two-day conference. For instance, in Albany, my state capital, there were 20,000 women at the conference, electing delegates and deciding on issues that they wanted to have discussed nationally. It started because the United Nations had declared first the Year of the Woman and then the Decade of Women, and in response to that, President Ford had himself selected, or someone on his behalf selected, a whole commission full of people, which was headed by a guy from the State Department, because it was the UN Year of the Woman, and he needed somebody, or they needed somebody to go to conferences. And it was that made Bella especially respond and say, wait a minute, if we're going to be represented, we have to know how, we have to determine how we're represented. And that caused her and other congresswomen to get legislation and funding to have this massive two-year process of a conference in every state and territory that elected delegates, selected issues, and then went to a meeting of 2,000 delegates and, of course, and thousands of people from around the country and around the world in Houston to come to a final listing of issues and concerns. It's really what brought the movement together, because until that time, there were groups that didn't want to include, say, discrimination against lesbians because they feared that it would make the movement unpopular, or didn't want to include reproductive freedom as a fundamental human right, But because of Houston, it and a long democratic process, we were able to come together, not in unanimity, but in huge majority on those issues.
What do you miss most about Bella Abzug?
Ah, so much. First of all, she loved conflict. You know, she found it funny and energizing, and I fear conflict, so I was always trying to learn from her. And she had an enormous sense of history, and she was perhaps better known in other countries than here because she was so globally active. I remember meeting a young woman who arrived in New York saying, "I am the Bella Abzug of Manchuria," or something. You know, right? And such a great sense of humor and down-to-earthness and yet global consciousness.
I'd like to go back to the reasons for writing this book. One, you said to tell these stories. And you said your first reason for the book was to share the most important, longest-running, yet least visible part of my life. And you say, we have to stop generalizing about the American people as if we were one homogeneous lump. I'm also now immune to politicians who say, I've traveled the length and breadth of this great land, and I know. And you say, I've traveled more than any of them, and I don't know. That's a very
right.
Taoist thing to say, Gloria.
Well, I do get turned off, don't you, by the television pundits who say the American people. Some of us arrived 48 hours ago. Some of us were here 100,000 years ago. We have all kinds of experiences, and we do have some things we share, which I think is a belief in self-government, although, you know, we need to grow in this belief because we have a voter turnout rate that is less than that in India with all of the poverty and lack of education in India. So, you know, we need a lot more belief in self-government. If there's one thing that distinguishes us, I would say it's hopefulness. And whether that comes out of the fact that so many people came from something worse or a fair percentage of people have seen their lives get somewhat better in their lifetime, I don't know. But I know that when I am in some other country, what makes me homesick is a feeling of missing that hopefulness.
So you were talking about the fact that we need to stop generalizing about the American people. And then you quote, Robin Morgan wrote so wisely, you say, hate generalizes, love specifies.
Yes, isn't that, I mean, Robin, you know, Robin Morgan is not only a great organizer and activist in the women's movement, she is one of the world-class poets of all time. And that single sentence has so much to tell us.
Yeah, hate generalizes, love specifies.
Yes.
And you add, that's what makes going on the road so important. It definitely specifies.
Mm-hmm. And I hope that people read. Robin Morgan has a regular blog, a regular column with the Women's Media Center, and a radio show with the Women's Media Center. She's a great source of energy and ideas.
For our listeners tuned in right now, Gloria, what other places do you think people should check in on a daily basis with blogs or articles, or where are your news sites?
I go online and look at, I'm still hooked on the New York Times. And in fact, when we got into so many false facts, I realized that I'd been cheating by getting the New York Times almost for free online, so I immediately subscribed because facts have become sacred after this presidential campaign. The Guardian in England, I find a very great source. The Women's Media Center is a great source to check on the media and find out, you know, what is accurate and what isn't, and who are, you know, trying to represent all Americans. I just think we need to understand, especially now, that facts are sacred, whatever it is that we ourselves are individually looking at.
You mentioned in your talk on the Women's March on the 21st of January, you said sometimes pressing send is not enough. So what do you encourage us to do then? If pressing send is not enough, what should we be doing?
It's not that you don't press send, no, but... mind you, because you can send queries and ideas to other people. And a lot of the success of the march, the contagiousness of the march, which was not just contagious in every place in this country, from small towns in Alaska and Oklahoma to huge marches in Washington, even bigger one in Los Angeles, but also in cities all over the world, you know, from Nairobi to Berlin to, you know, just everywhere. And probably a lot of people knew about the march because of pressing send, you know, because of the web. So it isn't as if it isn't part of the network. It's just that if we sit in our chairs and never leave our rooms and only press send, then we haven't been together with all five senses. That's important for us because otherwise you can't empathize if you're not present physically. You can learn intellectually, but you don't know what someone else is feeling. You can't empathize. It's very different to be present physically. And also remember that many women, a substantial portion of men and women, don't have electricity, aren't literate, don't have computers. So, you know, this is a universal form of organizing, and computers are not.
Well, you do mention as a second reason for writing this book, you say my second purpose is to encourage you to spend some time on the road, too. By that, I mean traveling or even living for a few days where you are in an on-the-road state of mind. Not seeking out the familiar, but staying open to whatever comes along. So how can the average person, or say woman, do that? What would you suggest? You say spend some time on the road, too.
Well, I don't mean to sound too Californian here, although I could do it on this show, but it does mean living in the present. So if I'm standing on the curb of my very own block and somebody's standing next to me and I'm pretty sure that we're responding to the same thing, I can talk to them or ask them a question. I remember once standing on my curb waiting to cross Park Avenue, and there was an elderly Chinese man standing with carrying bags. I think he was delivering food from a Chinese restaurant. And he turned to me and he said, "What do you think of Margaret Thatcher?" Okay, so, I mean, be open, you know, to the unexpected, to or to making some human contact instead of only having our minds on some isolated thing that's going to happen in 2 hours or whatever. That's an on-the-road state of mind.
Where haven't you been, Gloria, that you'd still like to travel to?
Oh, well, there are many places, I think especially in Africa, because after all, Africa's where we all came from in the first place. And there's something, I don't know, there's just a sense to being there. And there are many countries I haven't, I mean, I've been to South Africa and Botswana and Eritrea, you know, I've been to a few countries, but many I have not.
Well, Gloria, I was touched by the dedication of your book. Would you tell the listeners who you dedicated this book to?
Well, I dedicated it to a doctor in London who, when I was a student on my way to India, and I was waiting for a visa, and also at the same time, I was working as a waitress. I was there for several months. It was in the dead of winter. And I was realizing that I was pregnant and not knowing what to do. I mean, I had no idea what to do. I had all the fantasies about throwing myself downstairs or riding a horse. I mean, you know, I was...
You were only 22.
I really didn't know what to do. But I found the name of a doctor in the classified pages of the phone book and went to see him. And the second time I went to see him, this was 1957. Shall I read the dedication?
Yes, please.
Okay. This book is dedicated to Dr. John Sharp of London, who in 1957, a decade before physicians in England could legally perform an abortion for any reason other than the health of the woman, took the considerable risk of referring for an abortion a 22-year-old American on her way to India, knowing only that she had broken an engagement at home to seek an unknown fate. He said, "You must promise me two things. First, you will not tell anyone my name. Second, you will do what you want to do with your life." Dear Dr. Sharp, I believe you, who knew the law was unjust, would not mind if I say this so long after your death. I've done the best I could with my life. This book is for you.
How did it feel to finally be able to put that in print?
You know, it just seemed so natural, and then I was asking myself why I hadn't done it before. You know, because he was an older man at the time, so he is no doubt died long ago. And I think I had promised, you know, not to tell his name somehow kept me from saying it before. So I'm so glad that it just flowed out.
So he made you promise two things, and the second thing, that you will do what you want to do with your life. Seems to me you've done that, Gloria.
You know, I have in a crazy, imperfect way, even though when he said that to me, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I mean, I had fled in India both because I had a mother who was a theosophist, so I'd grown up knowing a little bit about India, but also because I was engaged and trying not to get married to a very nice and good man, but a very wrong man. It would have been very wrong for both of us. So when he was saying, do what you want to do with your life, I had no idea. And maybe that's why it came back to me, because I had begun to figure it out.
Your father plays an important role in your book, Gloria, and you say toward the very end of your book, in the afterword, "I wish the road had spared my father long enough to show him the possibilities of and instead of either or. If he'd been around when I finally created a home, I might have had something to teach him as well as time to thank him for the lessons he taught me."
I think we need to fill in here, too, for our listeners, that you were on the road with your parents as a young child. You can give us a brief history of that.
Yes, well, we had been living when I was a child in southern Michigan, in rural southern Michigan, on a small lake where my father in the summertime had a dance pavilion. But in the wintertime, he, who was very much a gypsy in spirit anyway, and didn't like the cold weather, would eventually, after the first snowstorm or so, put us into a house trailer, and we would sort of wend our way, buying and selling antiques along the way in order to make money, to Florida or California. So we had been, I mean, this way of life ended when I was 10 or 11, but it was all those early years.
You mentioned your father as you're concluding your book, and you also mentioned your mother. So I wish my mother hadn't lived an even more polarized life of either or. Like so many women before her and so many women now, she never had a journey of her own. With all my heart, I wish she could have followed a path she loved. But I think she's pretty typical. I mean, I think you could have said that about my own mother.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think a lot of us, I don't know how you feel about this, but I think a lot of us are in some ways living out the unlived lives of our mothers. And hopefully that will, I mean, it's an honorable thing to do, but, you know, now that more women can live their own lives, daughters will not have that, how shall I say, it's not a burden.
Regret?
Yeah, it's not, well, yes, regret for what my mother could have been, yes.
How can fathers today really give themselves a roadmap to to be supportive of the choices their daughters make, whether it's grand or whether it's just a you know, gap years, all the other things that are out there. I realize how lucky I was.
They, first of all, they can be equal parents, because if they want their daughters to know there are loving, nurturing men in the world who are not domineering, they have to be that. You know, we can't, we don't know it exists unless we see it. So if we have an a father who has been an equal nurturer of his kids, equal to, you know, the woman in the household, if there is a woman in the household, then we know it exists. When I see women sort of being attracted to men who are not considerate of them, it usually is the case that they had a father who wasn't considerate. So for fathers to model that is the most important thing.
You do have a chapter in this book called Secrets. And when I saw that title, apparently it hadn't been included in an original version of it. When I saw that, I thought, oh, is Gloria going to reveal secrets? Because you're being pretty forthcoming in the rest of your book. But what did you mean by secrets? Why did you have a chapter called Secrets?
I meant, you know, when I did the first version, the hardcover version, there just wasn't room for some of the things I wanted to include, which are things you have to look for, you know, that you don't just see them out the window of your car or just by voyaging around cities. And that means migrant labor camps, for instance, or prisons, or, you know, there are parts of this country that are sealed off, and I wanted to devote a chapter to them. But I think we're becoming, I hope and believe we're becoming more conscious of how evil and insane it is that we have, what, 5% of the world's population and 25% of the people who are imprisoned. So most of us have a prison near us, and why don't we know about it? Why don't we cross those walls and see people who are inside who actually are, you know, not different from us? I mean, mostly prisons are due to a failure of schools and drugs and poverty. You know, it's not people who are actually a danger.
Thank you so much, Gloria. It's been a pleasure talking
to you. Thank you both.
Take care.
And I look forward to seeing you.
We look forward to seeing you in Lackson Auditorium on March 1st.
Thank you.
I would like to also thank my co-host for today, North State Public Radio's General Manager, Beth Lamberson. And I would like to remind you that tickets to see Gloria Steinem in Lackson Auditorium are sold out, but tickets to a live simulcast in Harlan Adams Theater are available for $8. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.